Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, it's Stretner Hessen, and welcome back to the Modern Parenthood podcast. Today, I'm excited to have Dr. Andrew Sun visiting with us again to talk about various treatments for male infertility. So, Dr. Sun, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
This podcast is meant to provide information on reproductive health. It does not establish a physician-patient relationship, and we would urge you to contact your treating provider regarding your care.
And for our listeners, please like, follow, and subscribe. And if you have not heard our last episode, in our last episode, we talked about various testing for sperm and male factor infertility. In this episode, we're going to talk about various treatments for sperm infertility. But before we get to the treatment options, I want Dr. Sun to tell us a little bit about himself and what he does and his training.
Yeah, so I'm a urologist. Urology is the medical specialty focusing on diseases of the urinary and male reproductive tract. And after medical school at Harvard and urology residency for general urology at the Cleveland Clinic, I did a special fellowship, which is additional training. So at UCLA, I studied male infertility and sexual medicine. The official term is andrology, which means the study of man or men's health issues. And so my practice completely focuses on all disorders of sexual and reproductive health for men. So that's testosterone, that's erectile dysfunction, sexual dysfunction, and a large portion of it is male infertility as well.
Yes, and this is so important why, for our listeners, you go see a male infertility specialist, because Dr. Sun and physicians like him did extra subspecialty training in andrology and male infertility and sexual function. And it's so important that we get your information and your advice, Dr. Sun, for our listeners out there who want to learn about various factors and treatments that can affect sperm and sperm function.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, statistically, there's a greater than 50% chance, probably about 60% chance that in any infertile couple that there may be some issue on the male side that there has to deal that you have to deal with. And so we always advocate that, you know, this is a shared experience. Like, it's never, you know, just one person's fault or anything like that. It's just, it's a difficult journey. It's a shared experience. And we have experts like you and me on my side to help, you know, each partner as they embark on this journey.
Wonderful. Well, welcome to the show.
Yeah. All right. What are we getting into today?
Well, I like to start off my shows with a patient example, just to kind of get things going of what we're going to be talking about today. So let's talk about a patient. Let's say his name is Matthew, and he's 39 years of age, and he and his partner have been trying to get pregnant for about 5 years, and it was found that he has varicoceles. And so he underwent surgery to have the varicoceles repaired. And for our listeners out there, varicoceles are large dilated veins that surround the testicles. And the veins bring warm blood from our bodies around or exposes the testicles to the warm blood and therefore exposes the testicles to a warmer environment. But going back to Matthew, he had surgery to repair these varicoceles. 24 hours later, he developed a postoperative infection and ended up with a unilateral orchiectomy. So one of the testicles was removed because of a postoperative infection. His semen parameters, so examining the sperm count, motility, how fast it moves, and morphology, shape of the sperm, improved marginally since the surgeries. And so here he is. He wants to know what else he can do for treatments. So today we're going to talk about various treatments for male factor fertility. We'll spend some time talking about medical treatment, and then we'll talk about surgical treatments. In our last episode, we talked a lot about lifestyle changes, but I want to talk about medical and surgical treatments today. So Dr. Sun, in our last episode, we talked about various hormonal testing, FSH, LH. So FSH is follicular stimulating hormone, LH is luteinizing hormone. We talked about testosterone and estrogen levels in a person who has sperm or sometimes don't have sperm in their semen parameters. And depending on what those blood tests show, you may choose various treatments. And so when the partners of my patients come and see me, sometimes they say, I'm on an aromatase inhibitor like letrozole, I'm on Clomid, I'm on HCG injections. Can you tell us, Dr. Sun, which patients get which types of treatments? Which ones do you start off with? And how long does it take to see an improvement once they start treatments?
Yes. So many different options available, but really when you boil down all of medicine, like you said, we have two things. We can prescribe stuff and we can do surgery, right? And so, you know, when I talk to my guys and bringing it back to the physiology, you have a brain and you have testicles, balls. And so either the problem is in the brain or the problem is in the testicles. And depending on which one is which, you have one of two different options of treatments. We'll start with the more common situation, which is that the problem is the brain. And I don't mean like a brain tumor. I just mean that the brain hormones, FSH and LH, are kind of on the lower or normal end, but the sperm is not great. And so those guys, if I tune up their brain, if I crank up the volume from their brain output, then hopefully what I can get is the testicles to respond by producing more sperm and, oh, by the way, more testosterone, which might make you feel better. So the classic medication that we use that is called a selective estrogen receptor modulator, or a SERM. The main one is Clomid. Clomid, the way it actually works is it basically tricks your brain into thinking that your estrogen level is really low. And so in a man, you can't make estrogen. You have to make it from testosterone. So the brain's response to thinking that the estrogen is really low is to crank up the FSH and LH signal to tell the testicles to make more testosterone, because it's trying to tell the testicles to make more estrogen. And by the way, when you do that, you also raise the FSH, which makes more sperm. Sometimes this is just an empiric treatment and we try it, and usually it does help. Clomid, we use it very commonly. There's even more kind of interesting nuances in the use of Clomid as a testosterone therapy. And just because some listeners may be interested in this, Clomid is actually a 60-40 combination of two isomers, meaning molecules shaped in one direction. One's called zuclomiphene and one is called enclomiphene. The zuclomiphene has more estrogen-related side effects. The enclomiphene is more purely androgenic. And so we will also sometimes use enclomiphene as a way to naturally boost people's testosterone levels as like a separate thing. But generally for fertility, let's say we put them on clomiphene or name brand Clomid, and their FSH and LH goes up and their testosterone goes up, they don't necessarily feel like they're on, like, you know, testosterone therapy oftentimes, but their sperm does get better. What also happens when you do that is that they make more estrogen, because after all, that is the mechanism of Clomid. And, you know, testicles like testosterone inside the testicle. They don't really need a lot of estrogen. And so to further increase the amount of testosterone available to the testicles, you could think of testosterone as like food or fuel for the sperm production. You can also block that conversion of testosterone to estrogen. So aromatase inhibitors, aromatase is the name of the enzyme that changes your testosterone into estrogen. So if you take a blocker, anastrozole, letrozole are the two most common ones, then you get less estrogen and more testosterone. And usually I'll give those drugs together. So if a guy comes in and his brain hormones are lower, then I'll give him Clomid and, let's say, anastrozole to hopefully crank up the LH and FSH, get more sperm, get more testosterone, but not much more estrogen. In fact, maybe lower estrogen acutely just to drive sperm production. So that's one very common treatment. And, you know, generally for the guys that have like less than great sperm, but like, you know, it's there, it's just less than perfect, we do those medications alongside dietary modification, exercise, you know, vitamins, things like that. The harder problem is when the testicle is the source of the issue. Now, there are patients, of course, who on the semen analysis have no sperm. And if they have no sperm, there's actually a little bit more testing that we have to do first. There's something called a karyotype, which is kind of looking at all your chromosomes. And there's also a special test called a Y chromosome microdeletion assay, which basically means we're looking at the genetic code of the Y chromosome, because there can be pieces of it that are missing that are the cause of the inability to make sperm. Now, what I tell the guys is, look, I have like four tests, because there are three Y chromosome microdeletions and one karyotype. So we'll call it four tests. And if one of those tests is positive, it gives us some information. But there's probably 100 different gene things that could cause no sperm production. We just only have a test for four. So unfortunately, a lot of times, these tests still come back normal, and the guy's wondering, like, so what's going on? And I tell him, I don't really know what's going on. We don't really have a test for it, but we can still try the treatments that we have. So, you know, the zero sperm, the azoospermic patients, we do a little bit more testing to see, because there are a few of those, you know, Y chromosome type things that if they do come back, then we just kind of tell them there's a genetic impossibility of making sperm. Those are rare, but, you know, things that do occur. Testicle problems commonly can be, so the varicocele that you mentioned. Now, of course, that story very much scares me, because, you know, knock on wood, thankfully, we haven't had to lose a testicle from a varicocele repair. It's a fairly minor surgery. But varicoceles are common. They're vein collections around the scrotum that are dilated and make the testicle basically hot. And testicles don't like to be hot. Now, almost probably 15% of men have varicoceles, and not all of them are infertile. In fact, most of them aren't. So I tell people varicoceles can do three things. They can cause pain, they can cause decreased fertility, and they can cause nothing. And if they're causing nothing, then don't worry about it. It's not cancer. It's just, you know, let it be. If it's causing pain, we'll fix them for that sometimes. And if it's causing infertility, fixing the varicocele can help. It's about a 30-minute surgery under a microscope, very delicate, you know, half an inch incision or so. Outpatient surgery is pretty straightforward. And, you know, sometimes it can help a lot. It's hard to predict how much it's going to help. But, you know, for those patients, it could be on one side. It usually tends to be on the left. Sometimes it's on both sides, but left side is usually the bigger, you know, more chance of it.
Why? Can you tell us why the left side is more common?
Yeah, for sure. So despite what we think, humans are not perfectly symmetrical, and the vein system in your body is not perfectly symmetrical. So remember how I said that the testicles, they start in next to your kidneys when you're an embryo, right? And you're underdeveloping, they go down. Well, the right-sided testicle vein drains directly into the big vein in the center of the body called the vena cava. That's like the major highway that runs down the entire center of the body. The left side actually drains into the left kidney vein. The left kidney vein is smaller than the big vena cava, which means the amount of pressure in that vein is greater. So the backflow pressure of the blood trying to come back from your left testicle is higher than the one on the right, which means the blood can pool down in the veins of your left testicle. So it's like 95% more common to get a varicocele on the left side. So much so that historically they would tell you that if you just had a right-sided varicocele, you have to like look for a kidney tumor or something. That's basically been disproven. But 95% of the time, it's the varicoceles on the left is like the bigger one. It's very interesting how that works.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Tell us a little bit about the grading system. I see the grading system a lot as well for the varicoceles. So you mentioned earlier on whether it causes pain, no pain, fertility, no fertility, but there's also a grading system. And tell me, how does that influence your decision?
Yeah. So the grading system is called 1 to 3, and it's a little subjective. So one is like you can only feel the varicocele, like the veins pop out when the patient Valsalvas. Valsalvas, like, you know, pushing out your abdomen like you were having a bowel movement, or basically like straining, bearing down, right? So you bear down, the veins below your stomach, you know, in your scrotum dilate, and then you feel it, that's a grade one. If they don't need to bear down and you already feel it, that's a grade two. And if you can literally see it through the skin of the scrotum, like you pull down the testicle, the pants, and you're like, whoa, there's like some stuff in that scrotum, that's a grade three. Now, the data here is imperfect. It's not, again, a perfect correlation between like grade ones affect the sperm less than grade twos and threes. But in general, that trend is there. So, you know, I am much more likely to advise fixing a varicocele in a specific type of patient. And that patient has a bigger varicocele, let's call it grade two or grade three. That patient is younger, or more specifically, his spouse or wife or partner is younger, because the varicocele repair will take 6 to 9 months, even a year, to have like the full benefit from it. And if they're both already like 39, I'm just going to tell them we should just do IVF. And you know, ideally a patient that like is okay with having a surgery that's going to be a little bit sore for a few weeks and like that kind of thing. So you know, that's probably part of the reason why the data on varicocele repairs is not perfect, because when you stratify it out and just look at the really big, ugly varicoceles, the effect is more noticeable, right? When it's like sometimes like grade one, maybe I'm not sure we'll fix it anyway because we got to try something, like, yeah, maybe it wasn't really the varicocele in the first place. It also depends a little bit, I think, on how long it's been there. And so this is actually an interesting debate in the urology community between adult andrologists and pediatric urologists. The pediatric urology guidelines say don't fix the varicocele until the testicles have become a different size. The adults are like, if they're already a different size, then the damage is already done. You should fix it earlier so that you don't get infertility later. But probably as an artifact of the way that we see patients, you know, the pediatric urologist stops seeing the patients at like age 18. So they're not following the long-term fertility outcomes. So we are definitely more aggressive about fixing varicoceles when we see a size discrepancy, especially in younger guys. So I have a lot of patients that are like 19, 20, you know, the varicocele is not bothering them yet. The pain isn't bothering them much. They're not having kids right now, but I can already tell they're like a little bit different and it's a big varicocele. I'll sometimes tell them, you should probably fix this so that you don't accumulate another 10 years of damage before you, you know, decide to have kids or something. That's a very nuanced point, but varicoceles are interesting.
And does the varicoceles recur? I mean, so if you fix it today, 10 years from now, will they start to dilate up again? Is that a problem?
It happens. It's a low rate, you know, with microsurgical subinguinal varicocelectomy, which is the most sort of elite, I guess, way of fixing it, which is how we do it in fellowship. The recurrence rate's about 2%. It's mostly if you like missed a vein. With radiological embolization, so you can also fix these varicoceles by embolizing them like through the vein, the recurrence rate's a lot higher. It's probably like 10-15%. So I usually, now I'm biased because I'm a surgeon, but we also have an interventional radiologist that works in our practice, so we offer both therapies. Embolization is less invasive. It's also less complete. So generally our practice has been that we start with the surgery, and if there is a recurrence, then we do the embolization as like a spot treatment for like the one vein that's come back. Even if they do come back though, like they're never usually as big as the first one. And so like, you know, how much do they continue to affect the fertility? It's hard to say. Also the time length, by the time it does come back, like for a lot of patients, it may not be relevant for them anymore anyway, because maybe they're 50, you know, something like that. So it's obviously an individual patient thing.
Do some of these men sometimes still need medical treatment? We talked about Clomid and anastrozole, or even HCG. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about HCG, and do some of these men with varicocele repairs eventually still need medical treatment?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, even if the varicocele repair doubles or triples the sperm, if you were starting at, you know, 1 million and you tripled it to 3 million, like, that's still kind of low. So you might still have to add other things to it. Sometimes it's sort of an all-in-one, and you can either do them stepwise or you can do them all at the same time, depending on your time horizon and how aggressive you want to be. So on the medical side, you know, we had talked about Clomid and which raises LH and FSH together, and anastrozole. HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, is an injectable substance, very expensive injectable substance, that for all intents and purposes is LH in a bottle, right? So FSH is directly the sperm-producing hormone. LH is the testosterone-producing hormone. So LH in a bottle HCG, can be used in a variety of ways. You can use it as a form of testosterone boosting, but it's a very expensive and laborious way to do testosterone boosting when you have other methods. You can use it while you're taking testosterone replacement therapy to preserve your testicular size. And a little bit, I really stress, a little bit of preservation of fertility, but not, I don't want people to think that like, oh yeah, if I take testosterone and HCG, I'll be perfectly fine. You'll just be like 10% less, or you know, 10% less bad, right? And then, so we commonly use HCG as a part of a recovery protocol. So when we're taking guys off of testosterone and their testicles have shrunk over time, we put them on some HCG for a little bit to kind of rapidly jumpstart the testicles back into action to get them to grow again. So that's very useful. And then there are sort of exotic scenarios. There are a few rare brain conditions in which part of the brain that produces the FSH and LH called the pituitary gland is missing, or it's being crushed by like a tumor or something. It's something called Kallmann syndrome, where they're literally missing that part of the brain. Well, they don't make really any FSH and LH. So you have to give them the FSH and LH. And luckily, you can take FSH in an injection and you can take LH in an injection. It's complicated, it's expensive, but you can do it. And so those are the situations in which we would use injectable HCG and like recombinant FSH injections as well.
Fantastic. And we've talked now about medical treatments. We've talked about varicoceles and varicocele repairs. I want to talk a little bit about a vasectomy, previous vasectomy. I see this all the time. Man gets married in his early 20s. He has 2-3 kids. He has a vasectomy. And the marriage gets dissolved. And you know, now he's 45, meets his second wife, and wants to have children with the new spouse. And they're deciding, should I go and have my vasectomy reversed? Should I just do IVF with TESI, testicular sperm extraction, where we would take the sperm directly from the testicle? Can you tell us your counseling with this couple? Who should get the vasectomy reversal? Who should just go straight to IVF? What is your thought process when this couple comes to see you?
Extremely common scenario, and one that we see very, you know, all the time. Interestingly, and this is just a point about vasectomies, I did a research paper when I was in residency about vasectomy regret, we called it. And, you know, there are, when I was in training, and even to this day, there are urologists who won't perform vasectomies on patients that don't have children, right? They're like, oh, you're too young, you might change your mind. I always had like a problem with that because I didn't think it was right to put like your own moral judgment on like, you know, your performance of this procedure. And so when I looked at the vasectomy regret data, it's about 6% overall. 99% of that 6% previously had children. Almost none of the patients who had vasectomy regret were the patients that had, did not have children. In other words, like there are some people that just don't want to have children and they stay that way. And there are some people who want to have more children. And it's very common. And it's generally speaking, the scenario you described, right? Remarriage, oftentimes younger spouse. Now, when we're talking about vasectomy reversal versus sperm extraction with IVF, I think there are many variables. There are variables on the patient side, meaning the male, and then there are variables on the couple side. The patient side variables are factors relating to his vasectomy, how long ago it was done. The data shows that if it's between 0 to 7 years, your reversal chance is very high. 7 to 15, you know, decent, 80%. Greater than 15 years, 60-70%, right? So there's a big difference between I had my vasectomy 3 years ago versus I had my vasectomy 20 years ago in terms of the success. The surgery is arduous. It's very difficult. It's 3 to 4 hours long. It's under a microscope. The sutures that we have to use to reconnect the vas are many times thinner than a strand of hair. And so it's this very, very complicated surgery. It can be quite expensive because usually insurances do not cover this particular surgery. And then it's the question of what does success mean, right? And I think this is the biggest point that I stress with patients. When you go, and this is coming from a guy that does vasectomy reversals, right? So when you go and you see people say, you know, 99% chance of success, what's the definition of success? Well, the definition of a vasectomy success is zero sperm in the ejaculate. And the definition of a vasectomy reversal success is one or more sperm in the ejaculate, because clearly that means it worked. that doesn't mean you're going to have a baby naturally, right? That means you had one sperm in the ejaculate. So you can say 99% all you want. The problem is people conceptualize that as like, oh, 99% chance I'll be able to have a baby the good old-fashioned way. And the answer is no, it's a 90% chance you'll have at least one sperm in the ejaculate. So, you know, one, that's how you define success. Two, like, that's step one of like a 10-step process, right? You have to make the sperm, you have to get the egg, you have to fertilize, you have to develop, you have to carry the pregnancy. The take-home baby rate is a lot less than 99%. And then it rolls into secondary factors such as the woman's condition, you know, if she has medical issues, like her age, her fertility potential, all this kind of thing. So one, I explain to patients, like, remember, you got to think about it, that it's very difficult. It's somewhat expensive to do the VAS reversal. You might have to get another vasectomy afterwards if you still want to be like non-fertile permanently. It may or may not work, and that may or may not actually lead to your desired outcome, because there are situations in which we get 20 sperm. Great, vasectomy worked, the reversal worked, hallelujah. You still have to do IVF, you know? So it's like, why did I do that? And so the ideal candidate for a vasectomy reversal did not have his vasectomy very long ago and wants to have multiple more kids, right? Because then the cost-benefit analysis between, like, you know, a cycle of IVF versus a vasectomy reversal goes in the vasectomy reversal's favor, and the chance of it working is higher because they didn't have it that long ago. The more common situation, which is, you know, both partners are a little bit older, and they may want to have just one more child, sometimes the take-home baby rate is probably higher if you just extract the sperm and do IVF than it is if you gamble on a vasectomy reversal and hope that that's all you need, because it's very possible that that's not all you need anyway. And again, this is coming from the guy that does vasectomy reversals, right? So I would say we used to do more, and now, especially as insurance benefits have improved for IVF, especially as people have more knowledge in this space, it is becoming more common that I will just tell them, look, the better move here is just to extract the sperm and then get the embryos, and your take-home baby rate is higher that way, you know?
Fantastic. Dr. Sun, you brought up several very important points. The first is the vasectomy. So the vas deferens is a very tiny tube that you've described in a previous episode that leaves the testicle and brings the sperm to the outside world. So when that tube is transected or severed, that's how they have the vasectomy. And you're right, the vasectomy reversal, the tube is so small, you need a microscope to see it and to put it back together. And that's a fairly long surgery, just like you described, 3 to 4 hours long. And so you brought up a second important point in terms of success. Just seeing one sperm in the semen sample after vasectomy reversal is considered success. But I will tell you, as the IVF doctor, you're still going to turn around and still need to do IVF to get pregnant if there's just a handful of sperm in the semen sample after the vasectomy reversal. And so many times the vasectomy reversal, even if it's successful with just a few sperm returning to the semen parameters, the female partner still has to do IVF because there's not enough sperm to conceive naturally. So many times the female partner will still undergo the IVF process. Then it just becomes whether or not we're getting the sperm from the ejaculate specimen, meaning him just giving us a sample in the cup, or are we getting someone like you, Dr. Sun, a urologist, to come in and do a TESI, where we're going to take the sperm directly from the testicle and utilize that sperm to create the embryos. And just like you said, a lot of it's timing, how old they are as well, the age of that new female partner, and their timeline to having more children. And do they just want one more child or several more children with the new partner? And that's also important as well. And with IVF too as well, we can create several embryos, and so they can get pregnant, deliver in 9 months, and then they can come back in a year or two and utilize frozen embryos for subsequent pregnancies. One of the other things too with not doing the reversal is they still have permanent sterilization. So once they're done with their childbearing, they still have permanent sterilization to not get pregnant. So a means of birth control at some point in time. So there are many factors that we take into consideration when doing the vasectomy or vasectomy reversal. And just like you said, we're doing less and less of it now today. The same thing for me. We did tubal reversals. So women who had pregnancies with the first partner had their tubes tied and then wanted to have a new partner, or now has a new partner, want to have a tubal reversal. There was a long counseling process. But now with IVF, so much more successful with the improvements in the technology in the IVF lab, with the improvements of vitrification, so the way we can freeze and thaw embryos, the IVF success rate today is so much better than it was 10, 20 years ago. And so many times now, from the fallopian tube reversal standpoint, now the way I counsel patients today versus the way I counseled them 20 years ago is very different. 20 years ago, maybe we do some tubal reversals. But now with IVF being so successful and timeline being important for a lot of these patients, many times we go directly to IVF. And so I agree with you in terms of the vasectomy, and you have so many different factors to consider whether or not to do a reversal, and what's right for couple A may be different for couple B, may be different for couple C. And so taking into consideration their long-term goals is so important.
Absolutely.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And then, so one of the things we just talked about is TESI. So if, let's say, this couple did not do a vasectomy reversal and went to TESI, so TESI is testicular sperm extraction, I would love for you to tell our listeners about testicular sperm extraction, PESA, micro-TESI. What are these surgical procedures? What do these surgical procedures mean in a simple case in someone who has great sperm, just, you know, had a vasectomy in the past, but that's it? What do these procedures mean for someone with oligoastenotoratospermia, so OATS, low sperm count, low sperm motility, low sperm morphology, and for someone with complete azoospermia and in various aspects of the azoospermia, different causes of azoospermia, essentially. So what do these surgeries mean for someone who has a problem with the brain, meaning the brain is not functioning well to create the sperm, as well as these surgeries in someone where the problem is actually in the testicle itself? And are these surgeries helpful for those patients? So can you walk us through these various surgical options and what these surgical options mean for various patients with various diagnoses?
Yes. You know, at the end of the day, as a male infertility urologist, I can either do two things. I can either try and get your body to make more sperm, which all the things that we just described, or I can go hunting for the sperm and, you know, pull them out. And there are a lot of acronyms here, right? So TESI, testicular sperm extraction, micro-TESI or M-TESI, microdissection, testicular sperm extraction, PESA, percutaneous epididymal sperm aspiration, PESI, percutaneous epididymal sperm extraction. You know, as the viewers, like, don't get lost in all the acronyms, because they're all basically the same thing. I somehow get inside the testicle and take stuff out, right? The differences are, do I use a needle or do I open it? And do I use a microscope or not? I mean, that's really the difference. So I would say that there's really one or two surgeries that I do. We'll call it three. I mean, there's more, but we have varicose repair, we have vasectomy reversal, and we have sperm expedition, hunting, extraction, whatever version of it it is. Now, if the guy is post-vasectomy, right, and we know he has kids and we presume that he has, you know, great sperm, you can do a very simple percutaneous epididymal sperm extraction sometimes, which is you just grab the sperm out of the epididymis. You can do that in the testicle. You can cut open a little tiny window. You know, we can make up a term called a minimally invasive testicular sperm extraction, like a 3-millimeter window, and just grab some testicular tissue. Sometimes the testicular tissue is, the sperm in the testicle are a little bit different than the sperm in the epididymis. The sperm in the epididymis, they have a hat, so they can like penetrate the egg, and the sperm in the testicle are a little bit less mature, but that also means they're a little bit younger or fresher, and sometimes that, you know, difference can matter. There's a thing called like oxidative stress and DNA fragmentation. And there's some thought that if you get the sperm really early, you know, before it sits in the testicle for a while, then it's got like a healthier situation. So, you know, that that kind of forms the thought process there. But really, they're all just ways of finding the sperm. So if you know the guy makes sperm, it's pretty easy, right? It should be a slam dunk. You should get in there and somewhere you just grab the sperm. The more common situation that we end up doing these things for are the azoospermic patients, so the ones who have no sperm. So the guys that don't make sperm in the semen analysis, you got to tell them, look, I cannot tell you with definitive certainty if you don't make sperm, cannot make sperm, have no possible way of making sperm, or if you make just a few and I could maybe find some, you're just not making enough to come out in a semen analysis. And we can use the labs and different things to try and maybe predict the possibilities, but at the end of the day, you can never say never, but you can pretty much only say, we're not sure, which means at the end of the day, you may just have to go hunting. And there are a variety, you can do biopsy and whatnot, which is basically the same thing. But you can imagine that if you don't know if they make sperm, then you have to cut the testicle open and hunt for the sperm. And that's really what a microtessy is. A microtessy is basically just a very, very, very detailed and thorough sperm hunting expedition under a microscope to try and find something in the testicle. Now, oftentimes, these patients that don't make any sperm, they have smaller testicles. And so there's less real estate to kind of hunt for. And the common question that I get is like, how do you know when to stop hunting? And the answer is a little bit nebulous because you don't really know when to stop hunting, right? You could hunt the entire testicle away, but every time you grab a piece of testicular tissue to give to the embryologist to look for sperm, you're taking what's left of their testicle away, which means the factory that produces testosterone and everything is also going away. Although many of these patients have low T anyway, and they may eventually need testosterone therapy once they're done with the fertility picture. So at the end of the day, you know, if you can make the sperm, 90% of the time we'll use the sperm that's coming out, with that exception that we talked about with like the DNA fragmentation. If you can't get the sperm out, either because retrograde ejaculation, meaning you actually ejaculate backwards, which can be seen with diabetes, non-ejaculation or anejaculatory orgasm, which means you don't ejaculate at all, which can happen from certain spinal cord injuries and things like that, vasectomy, which is a very classic obstructive cause, or unknown, some genetic thing you're not sure of, then you go hunting. You go hunting some way, and we can just classify it as you make a hole in the scrotum and you go and look in the testicles for sperm, and you see what you get. And you know, those are not difficult procedures from a surgical standpoint, but they are difficult procedures emotionally because there's a lot of hope, anxiety, anticipation. Oftentimes there's a lot of disappointments, you know, at the end of it. And it's just, that's the hardest conversation that I have with guys, because I really have no good way of telling them what we're going to see except to go and see. And then it becomes a question of how do we coordinate this? You know, do we do this first? Do we see what we got? Do we do it at the same time as IVF? What happens if we don't find anything? Like, there's a lot of if-then nuances. So it's challenging, but you know, we have the power to basically scan under a microscope all the parts of the testicle and just hope that we find something. Before doing that, we'll usually medically optimize them with those medications we just discussed. Give it our best shot. Go for it. Go hunting and see what we get.
You brought up a very important point. So many times you will get sperm in one of these surgical aspects of retrieving sperm, but sometimes we don't. And how much is too much? And when do you stop? And when is, you know, how much hope do you give someone, but at the same time being realistic? And you also brought up a very good point. Do you do the TESI, microTESI first before the female partner undergoes the IVF, or do I do them simultaneously? I'm putting the female partner through IVF, and the same day of her egg retrieval, you're retrieving or attempting to retrieve sperm. And then one of the harder conversations I have with patients is, do we have donor sperm as backup, or do we fail this IVF and then consider donor sperm with the next IVF cycle? And that's a very difficult conversation to have. Psychologically, from the male's perspective, tell us what that means for his manhood and his ability, or the way he perceives things as not being able to procreate. And I will tell you, a lot of times I have these couples meet with a therapist first to be sure they're comfortable moving on with donor sperm. And for some couples, they fail one or two cycles and they're ready. But for other couples, they want to try everything and keep going and keep going. And how much is too much? And can you tell us a little bit about the donor sperm aspect and how you have these difficult conversations with these couples?
It's probably one of the most challenging parts of infertility, because of course it's always great and roses when everything works, but unfortunately in this field, sometimes it doesn't. And like you just said, we have couples that will kind of exhaust every opportunity. And because it's basically impossible for us to scientifically say that there's a 0% chance, there's always this like dangle of possibility. Now, I think over the years, I've become more realistic because I've just seen it happen too many times where people like pursue it to the nth degree and it just, doesn't work out. And so, but at the same time, I have to always caveat the end of my letter, statements by saying like, hey, I can't say zero, but like, there's a lot of factors working against us here. But it's challenging. It's challenging for everyone. Certainly there's sometimes a lot of cultural baggage in certain cultures when it comes to genetic versus non-genetic, parenthood, specifically paternity when I'm talking to them. Some couples have a plan day one, and it's actually kind of cool to see. Like we got if then scenarios for everywhere. And some scenarios, you're just hitting them like a freight train and they have no idea, what to think. And it's challenging. I think therapists do help. I think, a lot of patients come in with, very specific ideas of what like parenthood involves. And obviously the assumption is always like there's a genetic paternity aspect of it, but that obviously we know that doesn't have to be the case. DNA does not make you a parent, right? And so sperm donor is a conversation. It's challenging. I've had lots of interesting patients do it lots of very interesting ways. Just out of curiosity, because I always remember this, I had a patient in fellowship, and it was very unique. He had a traumatic accident, and so he couldn't have children. Naturally, he actually lost both testicles. But he had three brothers, and they were very tight knit family and everything. So none of the individual brothers wanted to be like the sperm donor. So what they did is they all three of them gave a sample, and they basically mixed it all together in the wash, and then they did IUI. And so like the sperm donor is one of the three brothers, but nobody knows exactly who it is. But like, I thought that was very unique. And then there are, sperm banks where you can get sperm. There's lots of different ways to kind of go about that. It's something that most people don't immediately think of. But once we're sitting with, as soon as I get, I'll take it back. I start that conversation immediately. As soon as I get azoospermia, so no sperm, I will at least open the conversation to start thinking about that, because I at least want them to have it in their mind that that's a possibility and to start working through the scenarios of like what that means. We obviously have some work to do and we have things to try, but I always want the patients to know every potential outcome that there is. But like you said, it's a hard one.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you have these conversations early on. So we start to what I call plant a seed in their air that, hey, this could happen at some point. And, things are looking lower and lower in terms of the prognosis and chances of getting sperm in the surgical methods for certain patients with azoospermia. It's interesting you brought up that scenario from fellowship where kind of all three brothers gave samples. And so when we have, when we tell patients about donor sperm, we talk about anonymous donors or known donors. So in the scenario you just gave to us was known donors. And the known donors, I'll tell you, it's a little tricky. Most people will end up going the anonymous route.
Yeah.
For a known donor, there's a lot of psychological evaluation that needs to be done, not just on the couple, but those three brothers in this example. Like, yeah. How would they feel if they knew they were the father of their brother's child? Will they see that child as a niece or nephew or as my daughter or son? So the psychological evaluation is important, as well as many times legal aspects. So defining paternity from day one, you know, hey, I'm donating that sperm to you, but you as my brother, you're going to be the father of that child. And so getting legal involved early on is very important as well. So known versus anonymous donors can be tricky and can be variable from couple to couple. And I see mostly anonymous donors. I think it takes that emotional aspect away from the scenario for many of these couples. It's just easier because the donor was anonymous and they just don't know, and it makes it a little bit easier. But in families like you just described, where it's a very tight-knit family, they've been educated about, hey, this is what happened, and our brother went through an accident, and this is what happened, and they're okay proceeding. I think in certain families, it's okay. And I've seen it as well on the donor egg aspect. In certain families, it's okay to have your younger sister donate, but 99% of the other families, it doing anonymous takes that element of knowing that, hey, my brother or sister could be the parent of my child, and it makes things less awkward. And so we see a lot of times people will do the anonymous route. And then also something very important you just brought up is when and how do we go about doing it? Like, some people keep going and going and going, and you know, they're not ready for donor sperm. And sometimes I tell them, let's try it first with your cycle and see what happens. Sometimes I say, hey, if I feel like the couple's kind of ready for this, I'll say, I'll talk about donor sperm, and let's purchase a vial of donor sperm and have it as backup. So let's say we don't get any sperm at the time of the testicular sperm extraction. Maybe we utilize the donor sperm for fertilizing the eggs. And then in some couples where they've done IVF before using testicular sperm, you know, it goes back to what you said. There's something about you getting some sperm, but are you getting good sperm that's capable of creating a good embryo and is essentially a live birth? I mean, ultimately, we're looking for take-home baby rate, to have a baby to take home. And in some couples, we're getting sperm under testicular sperm extraction, but when the embryologists go to use that sperm to create embryos, the embryos are lower quality. And in those couples, I say, oh, well, we'll do the testicular sperm extraction and we'll get sperm, but how about we consider fertilizing half the eggs with the testicular sperm and half the eggs with donor sperm? And that way we'll see if we get any embryos from either side. That way the female doesn't have to keep going through egg retrieval after egg retrieval. And so by having the embryos grow in parallel, one created with testicular sperm and one created with donor sperm, and see if we get better results. And sometimes we've been able to utilize the embryos created from the testicular sperm, but oftentimes we end up using the embryos created from the donor sperm. But it also is helpful for that couple to kind of see the embryos grow in parallel and to see the differences in development, because ultimately, it's not just, like you said, with a vasectomy reversal, you get one sperm, but there's so many more steps, and quality matters too as well. And ultimately, having that quality is important to having good embryos that will essentially result in a live birth. So that was really interesting in terms of your description, in terms of the various surgical aspects and what it means for men with various diagnoses. And of course, the hardest one, men with azoospermia, so not having sperm at all. And when do we have those difficult conversations? So thank you for telling us about the donor sperm aspect as well.
Yeah, totally. It's very, very tough, very interesting for sure.
Well, y'all know I like to end my episodes with a myth and debunking those myths. So let's take a patient, for example. Let's call him John, and he's 45 years of age. He is married to his second spouse, and he had children with his previous spouse. Now, John, different from our first example, John did not have a vasectomy. So he had three children. His youngest child is 18 years of age. And now he has a new spouse, and they can't have children. And he's saying to his new spouse, "Hey, there's no problem with me. I've had three kids. You know, look at these. I have three grown kids. Why don't you get tested, you as the female partner?" Can you tell us, Dr. Sun, about why it's so important to get the male partner tested, and you know, why having children in the past, regardless of whether or not you had a vasectomy, why children having children in the past does not necessarily prove that you are fertile today as a male?
Right. Yes. Also a pretty common situation. And, you know, the good thing about this situation is that he's at least partially correct in that, like, it is definitely a helpful predictive factor that he has children, because that means the likelihood that he's, like, genetically incapable of having children is well, pretty low, pretty much zero. Now, that was 18 years ago, and a lot can happen in 18 years, and you're not the same guy, the same health, and the same sperm factory that you are today that you were 18 years ago when everything was, you know, seemingly functioning fine. So I just tell the guys, like, look, I mean, the vast, vast, vast majority, 99% of the challenge of having children is borne by the women, right? Pregnancy is tough, childbirth is tough, being a mom is tough. You just got to ejaculate once, you know, like for most people, that's what you got to do. And so, like, go get a semen analysis. It's like usually less than $100 or like $100-$200. You know, it's one ejaculation of like many, many that you're going to do every year anyway, and just get tested. There is zero downside to knowing what's going on. And 18 years ago was a long time. What medications are you on? What health, you know, conditions have you accumulated? Are you taking testosterone? Maybe not now, but did you take it 3 years ago for a little bit? Like, there's so much that could have gone on. A semen analysis is so simple. Like, do, I'm very frank with my guys. I mean, they're all like, you know, dudes, and we just kind of like have a very casual conversation. Like, you just got to step up and like do the one thing and do a semen analysis, you know?
Wonderful. And so the semen analysis is a one easy, quick test to get done. So thank you, Dr. Sun, for being our guest today and talking about the various forms of fertility treatments for abnormal semen parameters.
Yes, thank you for having me. This is a fantastic conversation. Appreciate it.
Pioneer.